Good evening. Thank you all for attending. And apparently, if I turn this way, the mic goes away. Okay, it's good to know. As Dave mentioned, my name is Sam Rabadi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Western Region of Amish National USA. We're one of 50 sections of the organization around the world. It's a worldwide movement, an organization with 1.8 million members around the globe. I'm very proud to be a part of that organization, and I'm very happy for the invitation to be here tonight. Thank you very much for the hospitality. The topic of my speech is torture, which is a grim topic, but and a very important one, because as you may know, there's a debate currently going on within the United States about the appropriateness of torture. And I'm going to start the speech by telling you a little bit of a story. In 1961, a lawyer in London, whose name was Peter Benenson, who actually just recently passed away, a great man, he heard a story about two Portuguese students who were arrested and imprisoned for a toast they made in public to liberty. This man, Peter Benenson, felt outraged by this behavior on the part of the Portuguese government and began a worldwide grassroots movement known as Amnesty International. It became a decades-long struggle to defend the human rights of people all around the world. Whether governments were on the left or on the right, whether they were fascist or communist, whether they were capitalists or Maoists, Amnesty International's message was always the same: that human rights are inherent, inalienable, and universal. That human dignity must be protected, that nations, that the world is better served by human rights than tyranny. For this important work, Amnesty International won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. In that time, we've come face to face with unspeakable atrocities, except we've spoken about them. We've brought to light things that governments prefer to remain hidden. Terrible, ugly things that man does to man. In that time, we've come to know the many ways governments, armed groups, and others assault the human rights of individuals, families, communities, and peoples. And torture has been one of our greatest enemies. Its call is seductive, but its toll heinous. In its first major report on torture 3 decades ago, Amnesty International wrote, and I'm quoting, "Those who consciously justify torture rely essentially on the philosophic argument of a lesser evil for a greater good. They reinforce this with an appeal to the doctrine of necessity. The existential situation forces them to make a choice between two evils. The usual justification posits a situation where the good people and the good values are being threatened by persons who do not respect the rules of the game, but use ruthless, barbaric, and illegal means to achieve their evil ends." And this concept of necessity in relation to torture has been raised in this country in the war on terror. Having taken the decision to not apply the Geneva Conventions to those in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, people whom President Bush has described as bad people, who, quote, don't share the same values we share, unquote, the President sought to dispel concern about the treatment of detainees by saying that they would be treated in a manner consistent with the principles of Geneva. This has always been qualified, however, with a loophole for torture, namely the phrase, "to the extent appropriate and consistent with military necessity." In a report we released in 1984, we say, "Apologists for torture generally concentrate on the classical argument of expediency. The authorities are obliged to defeat terrorists or insurgents who have put innocent lives at risk and who endanger both civil society and the state itself. The accumulated evidence also gives a clear picture of the preconditions for torture: incommunicado detention, secret detention, and disappearance all increase the latitude of security agents of the lives and well-being of people in custody. And by framing the war on terror, this is no longer the quote, and by framing the war on terror as a unique event, something unprecedented in the history of the world, the U.S. administration has laid the groundwork for this argument. Except that this is not so unprecedented. Amnesty International's experience fighting torture tells us so. The torture and ill-treatment of Iraqi detainees by U.S. agents in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib prison was due to a failure of human rights leadership at the highest levels of government and was sadly predictable. There's a senior judge in the UK who says, quote, "There's a recurring theme in history that in times of war, armed conflict, or perceived national danger, even liberal democracies adopt measures infringing human rights in ways that are wholly disproportionate to the crisis," unquote. Certainly a glimpse of the history of the 20th century is enough to ring alarm bells following the crime against humanity which was committed against the United States on September 11, 2001. The situation contained classic ingredients that would demand principled leadership if human rights were not to suffer in the wake of such an atrocity. In the mix was an elusive, ill-defined, and demonized enemy, shortcomings in intelligence gathering, an official interpretation of the situation as new, unique, and requiring special measures, and an apocalyptic picture painted by the government of stark moral choice between good and evil by society and faced by society and wider civilization. We wrote to President Bush in 2 weeks after September 11 and reiterated our condemnation of the events of that day and urged him to remember human rights, not to lose them in the quest for vengeance, that the perpetrator should be brought to justice, but that human rights were in danger as a result of what happened. We urge the President to lead his government to take every necessary precaution in the pursuit of justice, to remember the victims, but not to go beyond what is allowed by international law. We regret that part of the United States' response to the atrocities has been to allow another chapter in the history of torture to unfold. And if you look back at even recent history, I think it would be instructive. In the late 1960s, for example, the Brazilian state faced social unrest as well as violence from small urban guerrilla groups. In the government's view, that both economic development and national security were under threat. The authorities took a number of draconian measures, none of which was open to judicial review. The one that had the most bearing on the practice of torture was the suspension of the right of habeas corpus for anyone charged with crimes against national security. From 1968 to 1973, widespread torture became a feature of the government's campaign against permanent subversion. On the other side of the continent, the coup in Chile on September 11, 1973, was followed by gross human rights violations. The Central Nacional de Informaciones was the agency most frequently cited as responsible for torture. People detained by or handed over to the CNI for interrogation were usually taken to secret detention centers, where they could be held incommunicado for up to 20 days. It was during this period that torture was used to obtain information, quote-unquote, confessions, or collaboration. The fact is, torture thrives on secrecy. Also in 1973, faced with a security problem in Northern Ireland, the British government passed emergency legislation, not unlike the Patriot Act in the United States. Not only did this relax the rules of evidence for the admissibility of confessions, it also allowed the police to hold those suspected of politically motivated crimes incommunicado for up to 3 days, raised to seven days the following year. In 1976 and 1977, there was a marked increase in allegations of torture and ill-treatment, just as the government was pressing the police for confessions for use in court. A significant factor in the rapid decline in police standards was the failure of government ministers and senior police officers to intervene with interrogators directly and forcibly, to make it clear that assault and illegal coercion were not to be tolerated. The security forces may have taken the extension of powers granted to them at the expense of the rights of detainees as a signal that the government authorities would tolerate violence against the detainees. Torture rears its head when legal barriers against it are lowered. Perhaps these circumstances sound familiar. If you look at the events for the past couple of years, I think you will agree. The U.S. administration can be seen to have fallen into a similar pattern since September 11, 2001. Although President Bush said that this, quote, new paradigm ushered in not by us, but by terrorists, requires new thinking in the law of war, unquote, whatever new thinking has been done within the administration, the result is old abuses. They include the denial of habeas corpus, the use of incommunicado and secret detention, a pattern of official commentary on the presumed guilt of detainees, the sanctioning of harsh interrogation techniques in the pursuit of intelligence, the blurring of lines between interrogation and detention, the setting up of military commissions which could admit coerced evidence, and a selective approach to international human rights and humanitarian law obligations. All of these contributed to a condition ripe for torture and ill-treatment. The photographs of torture and ill-treatment from Abu Ghraib did not come out of the blue, but followed by numerous allegations of abuse in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, raised with the U.S. authorities over the previous 2 years by the International Committee for the Red Cross, Amnesty International, and other organizations. When it suited the U.S. government's aims to build up to the invasion of Iraq, the administration quoted Amnesty International reports about torture in Iraq. But when Amnesty International brought its allegations and concerns about torture by U.S. agents, the response was denial and a disregard for concerns. It is tragic that in the war on terror, the U.S. has itself undermined the rule of law. Its selective disregard for the Geneva Conventions and international human rights law has contributed to torture and ill-treatment. The presidential decision that none of the detainees captured in the international armed conflict in Afghanistan would be eligible for prisoner of war status and not to bring such detainees before a competent tribunal to determine status as required by Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention contradicts the U.S. Army's own doctrine. The decision to reject the applicability of the Geneva Conventions was in line with many public messages sent by the administration that the war on terror would be waged according to new rules and that those captured during this global war would be treated differently. But, as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture pointed out, quote, although the status of the detainees may remain unclear, there is no uncertainty as to the international obligations, standards, and the protections that apply to them. The prohibition on torture being applicable to all individuals without exception and discrimination, regardless of their legal status. This is international law. There is no exception to the prohibition against torture. The immediate response of President Bush and other officials to the torture photographs was to claim that the problem was restricted to Abu Ghraib and a few wayward soldiers. On June 22, 2004, after leaking of earlier government memorandums relating to war on terror detention and interrogation options suggesting that torture and ill-treatment had been anticipated, the administration took the step of declassifying selected documents to set the record straight. At a press briefing, the White House counsel at the time explained how after September 11, the U.S. administration had to ask certain questions, such as, what is the legal status of individuals caught in this battle? How will they be treated? To what extent can those detained be questioned to obtain information concerning possible future terrorist attacks? What are the rules? He said, quote, as we debated these questions, the president made it clear that he was prepared to protect and defend the United States and citizens, and he would do so vigorously. But as the documents we are releasing today show, that he would do so in a manner consistent with our nation's values and applicable law, including our treaty obligations, end quote. However, if you were to take a look at those documents, you would see a completely different picture. If I were to single out one sentence from among them that calls into question the administration's stated commitment to international legal obligations, it might be the following, and this is a quote. "Of course, our values as a nation, values that we share with many nations in the world, call for us to treat detainees humanely, including those who are not legally entitled to such treatment," unquote. I don't know if you've noticed, but they've created a classification where there are people who don't, or are not entitled to those rights. The fact is, no detainee can fall outside the prohibition on torture or cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment. To suggest otherwise points to a serious gap in the government's understanding of international law and indicates that its views about fundamental human rights, that they view them as privileges that can be granted and therefore taken away by the state. That one sentence, repeated aloud by the White House counsel at the June 2004 press briefing, with no apparent recognition of the disturbing message it contained, was in a memorandum signed by President Bush on February 7, 2002, and classified secret for 10 years, and distributed to the main office holders in his administration. According to the White House counsel, this document is the, quote, most important, unquote, of those released by the administration. The legal concept of military necessity cannot lawfully be used to override the prohibition on torture. What happens, however, if a government willing to violate this principle perceives military necessity to require torture or ill treatment of a detainee, especially if it believes that there could be some detainees who are not legally entitled to receive humane treatment? I have actually a list of what's been alleged committed by U.S. personnel. This list is and does not claim to be exhaustive. Abduction, death threats, dietary manipulation, dogs used to threaten and intimidate, dousing in cold water, electric shocks, the threat of electric shocks, excessive and cruel use of shackles and handcuffs, including short shackling. I will give it, actually, just so people know what it is, this is what short shackling is. It's when you shackle both the hands and the legs together in close proximity, so you'd be like this. Excessive or accumulating use of strip searches, exposure to weather and extremes of temperature, false flag, which means that a U.S. agent will pretend to be from a different agency, from a foreign country, for example, Egypt, Syria, Pakistan, etc. Forced shaving, head, body, facial hair, forcible injections, forced exercise, hooding and blindfolding, humiliation, for example, crawling refers to make animal noises, immersion in water to induce perception of drowning, incommunicado detention, induced perception of suffocation or asphyxiation, isolation for prolonged periods, months or more than a year, light deprivation, loud noise, music, yelling, photography as humiliation, physical assault, for example, beating, punching, kicking, prolonged interrogations of up to 20 hours, racial and religious taunts, humiliation, religious intolerance, disrespect for the Quran, religious rituals, secret detention, sensory deprivation, sexual humiliation, sexual assault, sleep adjustment, sleep deprivation, stress positions like short shackling, stripping, strobe lighting, threats of reprisals against relatives, threat of transfer to a third country to inspire fear of torture or death, transfer to a third country for torture, threat of transfer to Guantanamo, threat of torture or treatment, 24-hour lighting, withdrawal of comfort items, withdrawal of medication, withdrawal of food and water, withholding of toilet facilities, leading to defecation and urination in clothing. At the Pentagon's April 2003 working group report, it states that interrogation techniques are usually used in combination. This can be illustrated by the recently revealed observations of FBI agents in Guantanamo. One reported seeing a detainee sitting on the floor of the interview room with an Israeli flag draped around him, loud music being played, and a strobe light flashing. Another wrote, quote, "On a couple of occasions, I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained and hand and foot in fetal position to the floor, with no chair, food, or water. Most times they had urinated or defecated on themselves and had been left there for 18, 24 hours or more. On one occasion, the air conditioning had been turned down so far and the temperature was so cold in the room that the barefooted detainee was shaking with cold. When I asked the MPs what was going on, I was told that the interrogators from the day prior had ordered this treatment and the detainee was not to be moved. On another occasion, the AC had been turned off, making the temperature in the unventilated room probably well over 100 degrees. The detainee was almost unconscious on the floor, with a pile of hair next to him. He had apparently been literally pulling his own hair out throughout the night. On another occasion, not only was the temperature unbearably hot, but extremely loud rap music was being played in the room, and it had been since the day before, with the detainee chained hand and foot in the fetal position on the tile floor." Unquote. The authorities have also invoked military necessity to prevent the International Committee for the Red Cross, ICRC, from meeting with certain detainees held in Guantanamo. Under Article 143 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, ICRC visits to civilian internees may be denied for reasons of imperative military necessity, but only as an exceptional and temporary measure. In Iraq in January 2004, the U.S. authorities invoked military necessity when they refused to grant the ICRC access to aid detainees in Abu Ghraib. According to one report, one of the aid detainees, a Syrian national, was at the time held in a tiny dark cell without windows, toilet, or bedding. The use of, quote, extended solitary confinement in dark and extremely small cells, unquote, was one of the torture techniques used under the government of Saddam Hussein, which the U.S. cited in its buildup of the invasion of Iraq. The inhuman treatment of this Syrian detainee, facilitated by the invocation of military necessity, was not limited to solitary confinement in appalling conditions. Around December 18, 2003, he was abused and threatened with dogs. According to the military, there's a photograph of him kneeling on the floor with his hands tied behind his back and an unmuzzled dog snarling at him a few feet from his face. During an ICRC visit in mid-March 2004, the organization's delegates were again denied access to him and eight other detainees on the grounds of military necessity. In January and March of 2004, the ICRC questioned the, quote, exceptional and temporary, unquote, nature of the denial of access. By the time of its March visit, the Syrian detainee had been under incommunicado interrogation for 4 months. By September 2004, after the Abu Ghraib photographs came to light, the administration's theory that the problem was restricted to Abu Ghraib and a few aberrant soldiers had been debunked. On September 8, 2004, eight retired U.S. generals and admirals wrote to President Bush noting that, quote, no fewer than 100 criminal, military, and administrative inquiries have been launched into apparently improper or unlawful U.S. practices related to detention and interrogation. Given the range of individuals and locations involved in these reports, it is simply no longer possible to view these allegations as a few instances of isolated problem, unquote. A day after this letter, the Senate Armed Services Committee was told that there might have been as many as 100 disappearances in U.S. custody in Iraq, prisoners hidden from the International Committee for the Red Cross at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency. At least one of these detainees died in custody, one of numerous deaths in U.S. detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan since the war on terror began. The death in U.S. custody in Gardez in Afghanistan in March 2003 of a young Afghan soldier, 18-year-old Jamal Nasir, allegedly after he and seven other detainees were tortured over a two-week period, only raises further questions about the real extent of the abuses and the adequacy of official investigations into them. Every year, the State Department releases a report on the state of human rights around the world. It's a report that draws on information from its own sources and non-governmental organizations. Under each entry, there's always a section on torture and cruel and inhuman treatment or punishment. And if you look at that report, it shows that the U.S. has been practicing what it condemns in other countries. If you look at a report, you'll see something like this, and these are quotes, these are actual quotes from the reports. China, prolonged periods of solitary confinement, incommunicado detention, beatings, shackles, and other forms of abuse. Indonesia, psychological torture cases reportedly included food and sleep deprivation, sexual humiliation. Iran, some prisoners were held in solitary confinement or denied adequate food or medical care to force confessions. Burma, they were routinely subjected detainees to harsh interrogation techniques designed to intimidate and disorient. There were reports in past years that prisoners were forced to squat or assume stressful, uncomfortable, or painful positions for lengthy periods. This is just like the list I read earlier about what the United States is doing right now. One additional point, and it's a very important one. Torture involves the dehumanization of the victim, the severing of all bonds of human sympathy between the torturer and the tortured. This process of dehumanization is made easier if the victim is from a despised social, political, religious, or ethnic group. Discrimination paves the way for torture and ill treatment by allowing the victim to be seen as not human, but as an object who can therefore be treated inhumanly. If you look around these walls, you'll see one of the uses of that kind of dehumanization, right? We're looking at class projects on World War II. I bring this up because you can buy souvenir t-shirts that are available to soldiers, or actually the soldiers can buy them, at the Navy Exchange and shopping mall in Guantanamo that perpetuate the view of war and terror detainees as less than human. One depicts a rat in a turban, orange jumpsuit, and shackles with the word Guantanamo Bay Taliban Lodge around it. Another depicts six shackled rats in orange jumpsuits surrounded by the caption Al-Qaeda Six-Pack Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Home of the Sand Rat. Such humor takes on different meaning when set against the experiences of real detainees. And looking at what's on around the walls here and thinking about the hate speech that was broadcast in Rwanda about the cockroaches and how the cockroaches all need to die, you can see that we're sliding, aren't we? And it's not to say that the United States doesn't face legitimate security concerns. It does. And these are considered concerns posed by groups determined to pursue their fight by abusing fundamental human rights without restraint. Governments have a duty to protect people's rights from such threats. There's never been a question of that. But in so doing, the governments must not lose sight of the other human rights and of their obligation to respect them. The UN Commissioner for Human Rights has said, quote, "Let us be clear. There is no doubt that states are obliged to protect their citizens from terrorist attacks. The most important human right is the right to life. States not only have the right, but also the duty to secure this right by putting in place effective measures to prevent and deter the commission of acts of terrorism. But counterterrorism cannot be taken at any cost. Insisting on a human rights-based approach and a rule of law approach to countering terrorism is imperative. For even though it may be painted as an obstacle to efficient law enforcement, support of human rights and the rule of law actually works to improve human security. Ultimately, respect for the rule of law lessens the likelihood of social upheaval, creating greater stability both for a given society and its neighbors. To flout the rule of law, To torture, to humiliate, is to undermine long-term security, even if there are perceived gains along the way. The brother of then Guantanamo detainee, Wazir Muhammad, told Amnesty International in Kabul in July 2003 that the U.S.'s treatment of prisoners, quote, makes the reputation of the U.S. bad amongst the people of Afghanistan, unquote. One of the alleged victims of the Abu Ghraib torture asked after his release about the effect of his experience on his view of the occupation of Iraq. He responded, quote, what would you do if I occupied your country, tortured your people, and violated all the laws of your country? Would you resist? Unquote. In a similar vein, a woman allegedly subjected to torture and cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment in U.S. custody in Iraq has said that her ordeal has made her, quote, hate Americans, unquote. And moreover, as a tool for collecting information, torture is notoriously effective, since people have this unfortunate habit of lying in order to make it stop, and has done little to solve long-term security threats. In fact, Hafiz Abu Saida, the head of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, argues that torture can actually promote terrorism. I quote him here. Torture demonstrates that the regime deserves destroying because it does not respect the dignity of the people. End quote. Members of the Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, are among those transformed from relative moderates into hardline fanatics after being tortured. After being tortured in Egypt, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, a surgeon, fled to Afghanistan to join the Mujahideen and eventually became Osama bin Laden's deputy. The U.S. government itself has said that, quote, states which demonstrate a high degree of respect for human rights are likeliest to contribute to international security and well-being, unquote. In his address to the UN General Assembly in September 2004, President Bush said that, quote, the security of our world is found in the advancing rights of mankind, unquote. The U.S.'s national strategy for combating terrorism stresses that creating a world in which the principles based on human rights, including the rule of law, quote, are embraced as standards, not exceptions, that they will be the best antidote to the spread of terrorism, unquote. In fact, the United States was one of the prime movers of the adoption in 1948 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This visionary document, from which today's body of international human rights law and standards has developed, it emerged in response to a time in which disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the consciousness of mankind, the conscience of mankind. It recognizes that the respect for the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. In the long run, a world built on human rights is a safer world. Torture is seductive because it appears to be a quick solution. But in fact, you're building a house on sand. It is not safe. It is unstable. Better that the house be built on a firm foundation, a bedrock of international laws and norms protecting the rights of all individuals and communities. As the future unfolds, does anyone here really think that it will be harder to create terrible weapons? More and more states are joining the nuclear family, as it were. Wouldn't it be better to make friends instead of making enemies? The United States' practice of alienating whole communities through torture, racial profiling, and other practices undermines this country's long-term security needs. Mistreatment plants seeds of resentment and anger in the individual and his family and friends and community. And thus, any government-sanctioned torture is certain to generate more embittered opponents of the United States. In preparing for its third international campaign to stop torture, Amnesty International conducted a survey of its research files on 195 countries and territories. The survey covered the period beginning in 1997 to the mid-2000s, and information on torture is usually concealed, and reports of torture are often hard to document, so the figures are almost certainly underestimated, but the statistics are shocking. There are reports of torture or ill treatment by state officials in more than 150 countries. In more than 70, they were widespread or persistent. In more than 80 countries, people reportedly died as a result. We are not in good company here. This is not a problem isolated to the United States, but the United States is where we live and where we, the people in this room, can make the biggest difference. We must understand that the use of torture is an affront to human dignity that can never be justified and must be opposed in every country of the world. Those who try to justify torture contribute to the undermining of the rule of law. They contribute to the undermining of this country's social, of the security needs. They are undermining basic human fundamental rights that everyone has. That torture, we need to understand that torture is illegal both under U.S. and international law, and it is immoral. Our own Constitution outlaws torture. It violates the Fifth and Eighth Amendments. And the United States has ratified the Convention Against Torture, which defines torture as any act which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is inflicted intentionally for purposes such as obtaining information or confession. The U.S. Senate ratified the treaty in 1994, and Congress later implemented the treaty by passing the Torture Victim Protection Act. No political or military objective or public emergency, whether it is combating terrorism, a state of war, the threat of war, or internal political instability, can justify torture. Under the Geneva Conventions, torture is prohibited in both internal and international armed conflicts. The U.S. government acknowledged this fact in its 1999 report to the UN Committee on Torture, stating that, and I'm quoting again, torture is prohibited by law throughout the United States. It is categorically denounced as a matter of policy and as a tool of state authority. Every act constituting torture under the Convention constitutes a criminal offense under the law of the United States. No official of the government, federal, state, or local, civilian or military is authorized to commit or to instruct anyone else to commit torture. Nor may any official condone or tolerate any torture in any form. No exceptional circumstances, I repeat, no exceptional circumstances may be invoked as justification for torture. It's certainly a different message than what we've been hearing lately. And finally, deporting detainees to countries so that they may be tortured for information there, or even threatening to do so, also violates both the Convention Against Torture and the Torture Victims Protection Act. The convention specifies that no state party shall expel, return, or extradite a person to another state where there is substantial grounds that the individual will be in danger of torture. And we've heard reports of people sent to Pakistan, to Egypt, to Jordan, for torture, specifically. So, it's a pretty grim picture we paint. And what do we need to do about it? We, the people in this room, have already taken the first step, which is coming and getting educated about this issue. And from this point forward, well, it's up to you. What I will say is that there is a battle going on now, and it's not the war on terror. It's a battle for the hearts and minds of the American people, for the values of the American people, and it's one where I greatly fear the consequences of losing. So, when someone brings up the issue of torture, what can you do? You can let them know how you feel. You can let them know what you've learned here, but other things you may have heard. When someone says, well, you know, if to stop terrorism, it can't be bad, right? Well, yes it can. Because how do you know that you have the right person? How do you know if even you'll get the correct information? Torture is like a cancer. Once you open the door, it spreads like wildfire. When you hear about something in the news, you can write to the local paper. Let them know what you've learned. Your representatives and government in California, government in D.C., they especially need to hear how you feel. It's vitally important that they know and then act appropriately, that their constituents do not want to see an America where torture is tolerated, where it's commonplace. Because the fact is, torture is immoral as well as illegal, and torture does not work in the long run. America is not supposed to stand for torture, but increasingly in the eyes of the world it does. America is not supposed to tolerate torture, but increasingly in the eyes of Americans it does. This is a dangerous slope we're on. I hope you come and join us in Amnesty International and others in the struggle to stop this terrible slide. And that's it. Thank you very much.